So we're still on slide 17. Remember that this complex of purple things represents an electron transport chain. And electrons get delivered to it by coenzymes, NADH, NH+, and also FADH2. When they pass those electrons down the chain, that releases energy because the electrons are getting closer to nuclei. And that release of energy is what powers the pumping of protons. That's what I was talking about when I said complex 1, 3, and 4, not 2, but the other 3, not only function as members of the chain, but they also function as proton pumps. Now, what I didn't say, and I should have really, is that anatomically, this electron transport chain and all the thousands of others that are just like it are physically embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. So you don't see the membrane here, but that's where they are. They are membrane-bound proteins that are part of the inner membrane of the mitochondrion. And so the three complexes, 1, 3, and 4, that operate as pumps are going to be pumping protons through that inner membrane. So now, what are the two compartments that the inner mitochondrial membrane separates? If you... Here's just a stylized mitochondrion. That's the outer membrane. The inner membrane has the folds in it, right? So this is the membrane. This inner membrane is where these electron transport chains are. So what are these two compartments called that it separates? Yeah, this is the matrix. And the other side is between the two membranes. So that's the inner membrane space. Right, intermembrane, between membranes. Okay, so when there's pumping of protons by these three members of the chain, the pumping is from the matrix, that's where it's getting the protons, pumping them through the inner membrane to the intermembrane space. All right? And the energy that's required to pump that, because any pumping requires energy, comes from the energy that these electrons are releasing as they go to a more stable, a lower energy level. All right? Now think about what's happening here. The fuel has already been spent in the previous part. Citric acid cycle spent the fuel entirely. Some energy is in the form of ATP that was produced previously. That's good. Some energy was lost as heat, but there's no more energy at all left in the fuel. The energy that was remaining was in those coenzymes, NADH, NH+, and FADH2. Is that correct? Not just because I'm saying it, that's correct. That's what happens. But what I wanted you to think about what's happening is that when those electrons get delivered to the chain, you're depleting that last remaining non-ATP source of energy, right? The reduced coenzymes were holding the energy that was in the glucose, right? Now it's no longer there because they've been reoxidized into empty taxis. So the energy has been spent by these electrons flowing downhill, basically, energetically downhill. Why is that not a waste? Because we noticed we haven't made any ATP in this step at all, which is electron transport. So now there's not only no fuel left, there's no more coenzymes left that are reduced. Why is that not a waste of energy? Where, in other words, where is the energy now after all that's done? The usable energy. Yeah. It's not in the protein chain anymore because the electrons have trickled down that chain and released their energy. So where is the usable energy that was originally in glucose and still hasn't been put into the form of ATP? It's no longer in the coenzymes because they've reoxidized. Well, when I talked in here for the purpose of a lab about diffusion and active transport, remember that laboratory lecture? What did I tell you to always keep in mind about a gradient? It is a form of stored energy. So the energy has been spent to power these pumps so that they can pump protons from the matrix to the intermembrane space, but that means a gradient of protons has been created, right? The proton gradient now is the form of energy that used to be in glucose. So you've stored it temporarily in coenzymes by stripping the fuel of hydrogen. Then you dumped it off of the electron transport chain and put the energy into the form of a gradient that was created by pumping protons. And as long as you have that gradient and things are set up properly, remember that a gradient can do some work for you. And that is exactly what the only remaining step is. To let that gradient finally then pay off, which means energy that used to be in glucose pay off, for the purpose of producing many additional ATP molecules. That's what chemiosmosis, the second part of oxidative phosphorylation, is. Okay, that's the part where the phosphorylation actually takes place. Electron transport doesn't involve any phosphorylation. It just involves the establishment and maintenance of a proton gradient to store that energy to be used in the next step for phosphorylation. Now, the only thing I haven't talked about here is what happens at the end. Now, I've taught 23 different courses, and they all deal with a lot of the same themes, even though they're different courses. But in almost all of them, I ask students the same question, and it seems like a simple question, but very few students are actually able to answer it right away. And the question is, why do we need oxygen? Now, the answer is not because you'll die without it. That's just another way of saying you need oxygen. What does oxygen actually do for you that is so important that you have to breathe continuously in order to continuously get oxygen? Well, it's going to be incorporated into a water, that's true, but we don't need oxygen for the purpose of making water. That's just a byproduct of what happens. Why is it that we actually need oxygen? What's it doing directly? Okay, well, I'll answer that in a minute, but let's see what's happening in this electron transport chain. If you imagine the bucket brigade again, which is a good analogy, just a real-world analogy, if the last person in the bucket brigade does not spill the bucket, hangs on to the bucket instead, that member won't be able to receive a new bucket from the one before him or her, right? Which means the second to last person will be stuck there with a bucket they can't get rid of. And so on all the way up to the beginning of the bucket brigade, right? Same thing with the electron transport chain. If the last member of the chain holds on to the electrons, then it can't receive any more electrons. And the whole chain will fill up with electrons. And what happens then? When the whole chain fills up with electrons, the first member of the chain, complex 1, will no longer be able to receive any electrons from NADH, the coenzymes that are delivering their electrons. All right, now what happens if that happens? Well, these taxis can constitute a fleet. There's so many taxis, right? It's not an infinite number. There's so many taxis out there, so many NADs, that are, you know, individually they're either NADH or they're NAD+. They're in one of the two forms. But if they are continuously picking up electrons and becoming NADH, but the electron transport chains are all full so they can't dump them onto the chain, then they're stuck as full taxis and they can no longer pick up any more electrons from new fuel, right? That means everything all the way back to glycolysis would shut down. Because those steps that produce the NADH and H+ out of NAD+, that's not just a good consequence. The NAD+ is necessary for that reaction to occur. So in other words, you need empty taxis to become reduced to allow those reactions to occur. So that means everything all the way up to glycolysis would stop if the chains filled up. The chains won't fill up if the last member of the chain has something it can dump its electrons onto that's actually external to the process, meaning it's not a member of the chain. And that's exactly what oxygen does for you. And it's almost the only thing that oxygen does for you, because otherwise it's kind of a destructive molecule because it's highly reactive. That's why we talk about antioxidants, to undo that damaging effect. But oxygen serves as the final electron acceptor in cellular respiration. Okay? Now, why is oxygen ideally suited for this role? It's not the only thing that can be a final acceptor, but it is for the vast majority of respiring organisms, including us. In other words, we not only undergo cellular respiration, our version of cellular respiration is called aerobic respiration, because we use oxygen as that final acceptor. It does a really good job at it, but why? Why does oxygen make such a good electron acceptor? It's not polar, no, it's just an atom by itself. Well, an oxygen molecule, yeah, is nonpolar because it's two oxygens. But just think of oxygen as an element. What makes it a good electron acceptor? It has a high electronegativity, like we've talked about several times, right? That's what causes an OH bond, like in water, to be polar, because the high electronegativity of oxygen means it wants those electrons more than the hydrogen does. That's what makes it an unequal sharing. So that high electronegativity means oxygen will gladly take those electrons from complex 4, the last member of the chain. And that's what happens here. And notice that's a big drop in G when you go from that last member to oxygen. It's that much of a jump. Okay? Now, it's not only electrons. If you think about it, the hydrogens that started out in the fuel, each individual hydrogen is an electron and a proton, right? Well, they go different ways. They go separate ways temporarily. The electrons from the fuel, from the hydrogen in the fuel, trickle down the electron transport chain, powering the pumping of the protons that also came from the hydrogen of the fuel. And then when oxygen receives the electrons, it also receives the protons. In other words, oxygen receives hydrogen. It's not necessarily the same proton and electron that get back together, but in a sense it's a reunion back into hydrogen atoms. And when you add hydrogen to oxygen, you make water. That's why it ends up being water. Okay? So remember when we looked at the combustion reaction, you have fuel reacted with water, and if it's a carbon-containing fuel, like glucose, then the products will be CO2 and water. So the oxygen that we breathe serves as the final electron acceptor, and it turns into, or it gets incorporated into, water when the hydrogen from the food we eat gets added to it. And in that process, a lot of energy is released. The usable part that's not wasted as heat has, at this point, been stored as some ATP, and the rest of it is in the form right now of the proton gradient. Now it's time for that gradient to pay off. So let's go to the, go ahead.
Is that why we have so much water inside our body?
Well, not all of that water is metabolic water. We make water metabolically just by undergoing cellular respiration. But that's a tiny fraction of the overall body's water, because that's why we drink. You know, we're continuously replenishing water that was water to begin with. This water that we're talking about isn't water to begin with. It's oxygen and hydrogen from two different places that get together. Yeah?
What is it called again whenever you use active transport to create a gradient to another transport?
You're talking about secondary active transport?
Yeah. Okay, that's just what I mean.
Yeah, but this is not actually secondary active transport. This is primary active transport, but powered by something other than ATP. Because you wouldn't want to use ATP to build ATP, right? It's powered by the decrease in energy as the electrons get transported. They're at a higher energy level in the food. They end up at a lower energy level when they finally make it to oxygen. And that energy powers the pumping of the protons. So now we can talk about the payoff, the final payoff, which is step two of oxidative phosphorylation. Which is really, when you think about it, part two of part three of part two, right, of the overall process. The overall process is the complete oxidation of glucose. That has two parts, glycolysis, cellular respiration. Cellular respiration is part two in that sense. Part three of cellular respiration, which is part three of part two, is oxidative phosphorylation, which has two parts to it. And we're about to look at the second part of that, which is chemiosmosis. Okay, that's what I meant by part two of part three of part two. Now, the little molecular machine that we're looking at in cartoon form in slide 18 is called ATP synthase. Notice the A-S-E ending, so it's an enzyme. It's an enzyme that helps out in the process of synthesis. Synthesis means getting things together to build something. So what gets synthesized in this process is ADP and inorganic phosphate. In other words, a phosphate on its own. When you synthesize those two, what you're really doing is phosphorylating the ADP to make ATP. And this is a little bit different from how ATP was produced via substrate level phosphorylation, which is what happened in glycolysis and the citric acid cycle. This is oxidative phosphorylation, because what really powers this is the first part, which is electron transport. Electron transport is the oxidative part of it, right? Because it's redox reactions, like you were saying. Okay, so that's the oxidative part of it. That's already happened, and that's paid off in the form of a proton gradient. The proton gradient then pays off in the form of phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. Now, this proton gradient that was formed was because of the pumping of those three members of the chain I talked about. And so it's a high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space, a lower concentration in the matrix. As soon as you have a gradient, though, you have a tendency for diffusion, right? The protons want to diffuse, but remember, that's not enough. Two requirements for diffusion are that you have to have a gradient, and you also have to have a way for that particle, whatever it is, to get from place A to place B. So the protons want, in a sense, to diffuse back down their gradient from the intermembrane space to the matrix. The gradient is that tendency, right? But they are blocked from getting directly through the phospholipid bilayer, which is what makes up the bulk of that membrane. For what reason? Why can't they go right through the membrane? They're small as hell, right? These are protons. They're not even as big as an atom. So they're plenty small, but they're beyond polar. They're not only polar, they're fully charged. They're ions. And ions, because of their charge, don't like to be around these non-charged, non-polar phospholipid tails. So they want to come back down their gradient, but they can't just anywhere in the membrane. And the cell is set up in such a way that there are only certain places where they can actually go down their gradient. And those places are the many copies of ATP synthase. So this is not only an enzyme, it also serves as an ion channel. Right? We talked about channels. Well, it's a special channel. First of all, it's only hydrogen ions that are allowed through. But when they do that, well, let me back up in a second and tell you about the makeup of the machine. The whole thing is a molecular machine. You have the blue part and the purple part. One of those parts moves with respect to the other, and the other one stays put. These are the same words that are used in motors. You have a stator and a rotor. Static means not moving. So the stator stays put. It's embedded in the membrane. But it's a complex of proteins, okay? The rotor rotates. But it doesn't rotate on its own. It has to be forced to rotate, just like a water wheel has to be forced to rotate, right? By water falling on it, which does some work for you. That will, through gears, turn the mill and grind corn or whatever at a water wheel. Well, here what turns the rotor is the hydrogen ions that are diffusing passively down their gradient through the inner membrane from the intermembrane space back into the matrix. So that's like water falling downhill. But that turns the rotor with respect to the stator. And on the matrix side of this, there is this catalytic knob, as you see. It's part of the rotor system. It twists. And every little bulb, every little head of this catalytic knob is its own enzyme with its own active site. But unless it is being deformed by turning, it won't operate as an enzyme. So as long as it's turning, an ADP will come in and an inorganic phosphate will come in as substrates, bind to it, and get hooked together. But this is not substrate level phosphorylation because the phosphate is not being carried by a substrate to begin with. It's on its own. Okay? So as long as this thing continues to turn, you can continue cranking out ATP by oxidative phosphorylation. But when would this thing stop spinning? When there's no more gradient, right? And that's why for this to keep working, you have to continuously pump protons from the matrix to the intermembrane space. And what is necessary to keep pumping those? A continuous flow of electrons from the coenzymes, NADH and FADH2, which requires a continuous catabolism of fuels, right? You need to continuously burn the fuels to get those electrons from the fuel, trickle them down the electron transport chain to pump the protons, which then diffuse back, spin this ATP synthase to make more ATP. And not just more ATP, much more ATP. That's why this is the big payoff. And this is why I was saying earlier that each individual NADH actually is carrying enough energy to eventually make multiple ATPs. And when you have multiple NADHs plus multiple FADH2s, it's a big payoff in that final one. More than 90% of the ATP that's made, if you completely use a glucose, is made in this final step, much less by substrate level phosphorylation before that. So we have this third overall step of cellular respiration shown in slide 19. This is oxidative phosphorylation. You see the two parts of it together, though. We haven't seen it together before this slide. So here is just one of several copies of an electron transport chain embedded, as you see, in the inner membrane. You have complex 1, 2, 3, and 4, but only 1, 3, and 4 are actually acting as pumps. They can't pump protons, though, unless you supply them with energy. The energy is supplied by the electrons that go to lower and lower energy level as they get passed from one member to another. Where do the electrons come from? Well, glucose originally, but they come directly from reduced coenzymes that picked them up from the fuel along the way. In glycolysis, in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, and in the citric acid cycle. All of those produce NADH, NH+, plus the citric acid cycle, in addition, produces FADH2. So they're all dumping their electrons on, they're all trickling down, that's pumping more and more protons, keeping the gradient steep. And then those hydrogens can only diffuse back through ATP synthase molecules, which is what turns them, causing chemiosmosis. The first part of oxidative phosphorylation is the electron transport itself. The second part is chemiosmosis, and that's where ADP is phosphorylated into ATP. Now, notice that oxygen was only used in one place. Glycolysis does not at all require oxygen. But if this was the only thing happening, glycolysis and cellular respiration, then even though glycolysis doesn't require oxygen, being deprived of oxygen would still shut it down, like I said before, because it would end up filling all your available NADs and FADHs, or FADs, I should say, filling them all up with electrons, unable to dump them anymore. You'd have nothing but reduced coenzymes. Well, the steps of glycolysis where you produce NADH, those require NAD+. So if you don't have any oxidized coenzymes, NAD+, those can't happen. So it would shut down even glycolysis. And that would be deadly, of course, because you wouldn't be able to make any ATP. But there's something that has evolved to solve that problem. I'll get to that in a second, but first let's look at this summary slide. Slide 20. This is the whole thing. By the whole thing, I mean not just cellular respiration. It's the whole process of this chapter, the complete oxidation of glucose. It starts with glycolysis out in the cytoplasm. Glycolysis is a hexose, 6 carbons. Glycolysis in its 10 steps breaks that 1 6-carbon glucose into 2 3-carbon pyruvates, which is still valuable fuel, but in the process creates some valuable energy-carrying molecules, NADH and ATP. ATP by substrate-level phosphorylation. The NADH then delivers its electrons to the mitochondrion, and the pyruvate gets delivered to the mitochondrion so that the second part of this breakdown of the fuel can happen, which is cellular respiration itself. And that has 3 parts, remember. The first part, shown right here, is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That's when the pyruvate comes into the mitochondrion, but it gets stripped of one of its carbon that comes off in the form of CO2, totally spent fuel, leaving 2-carbon acetyl that gets picked up by coenzyme A and delivered to the citric acid cycle. But in that course of that decarboxylation, energy is also extracted usefully in the form of more reduced coenzyme, NADH. Okay? Now you have the citric acid cycle, which completes the oxidation of the remaining fuel, which is only those 2 acetyls. It's two because, remember, there's two for each glucose that you started with. By the time that's done, you have no more fuel, but you've produced a couple more ATPs via substrate-level phosphorylation, and you've produced even more NADH and more FADH2. And FADH2, not more FADH2. So now, all of these taxis from the various places that are carrying high-energy electrons dump those electrons onto the electron transport chains, which are the first part of the third step of cellular respiration, oxidative phosphorylation. The passing of electrons down those chains from complex to complex releases energy. And that energy is used to power the pumping of protons through three of those complexes so that they're taken out of the matrix and pumped into the intermembrane space, creating a gradient. Now the protons want to diffuse back into the matrix, and the only place they can do that is through the ATP synthase molecules, which spin and phosphorylate ADP into ATP. That's the final payoff. But look at the numbers here. Only four ATP in the first place, couple places where it's substrate level, and then up to 34 ATP by oxidative phosphorylation. So it's a hell of a lot more, and therefore worth it to not just stop at glycolysis. Because you could stop at glycolysis, you make some ATP, right? But you still have a lot of usable energy that you could have been using. That's why cellular respiration was such a successful thing that evolved originally in bacteria. Okay, but now back to this story, we're on slide 21 now, about what happens if there's no oxygen. If there's no oxygen, cellular respiration is just going to stop because everything will back up, right, as the electron transport chains get filled. And I said that that would also stop glycolysis, but not because glycolysis needs oxygen. It's simply because glycolysis needs NAD+, oxidized coenzymes, in order to reduce them. Because otherwise it's not going to be able to strip those hydrogens from the fuel unless it can put those hydrogens onto NAD+ to make it NADH. That's why it requires it. But if all you have is NADH and none of them are empty, then it would come to a halt, except for this alternative process. So remember I said cellular respiration happens first in all cases. It's like a road. But then you get to a fork in the road, and you have two possibilities. Cellular respiration, which, if it's available, is definitely worth taking because of what I just told you. But that means you're going to have that final electron acceptor, which is what oxygen does, right? Because only if you have oxygen will you be able to continue the process so that NADHs get turned back into NAD pluses, which will allow glycolysis to continue to happen. If that all backs up, you still need some way to allow glycolysis to happen. And that is called fermentation. So this is up here is cellular respiration. Okay, now there are all kinds of different fermentation techniques. Any one species does only one kind. But we're showing two here. Don't think that there are only two kinds of fermentation. There's many different kinds that different species have, but there's two that we usually talk about in books because there's two that humans care about, really, most humans. One of those is on the bottom, lactic acid fermentation. The reason we care about this one is because this is the version of fermentation that we actually perform in our own cells. Okay. The reason we care about the other one, which is alcohol fermentation or ethanol fermentation, is because, yeah, we want the alcohol for various reasons. Not only to drink, but it's important in cheese making and bread making and all kinds of different processes. Okay, so it's important for humans for that reason. But even if it's, no matter whether it's one of these two types of fermentation or any of the other kinds that exist in nature, it's always for the same reason that these processes evolved. They all accomplish the same thing that's important, just in different ways. And that important thing that all fermentation techniques accomplish is the reoxidation of NADH back into NAD+, so that fermentation can still happen. Okay? Now you don't have to worry about this with cellular respiration, because cellular respiration reoxidizes the NADH when it dumps it off into the chain. If you don't have that, you have to have something else do that job for you. So now fermentation does not produce by itself any ATP. So that's not why the cell is doing it. Notice you have ATP being produced here, but that's the ATP that gets produced by glycolysis. The only thing that fermentation is doing is allowing that glycolysis to continue to happen. Let's look at the alcohol version up here first. Glycolysis is normal, as we've already talked about, but in the process of those glycolytic reactions happening, NAD+ gets reduced into NADH. That's good because it's storing the energy, right? But that's what fills up the taxis. So that's the problem if they all get filled. Therefore, you have this black arrow down here, which is the fermentation part of this whole process. And that is what reoxidizes the NADH back into NAD+, so it can then go pick up more hydrogen from glycolysis. So you can keep making two ATP at a time. But remember that pyruvate is what gets spit out of glycolysis. Well, in species that have alcohol fermentation, that pyruvate then gets decarboxylated, and it forms something, a two-carbon compound called acetaldehyde. Okay? It's an aldehyde. But that is just an intermediate. That acetaldehyde then gets converted into ethanol, which is a two-carbon alcohol. That's the same alcohol that's in all alcoholic drinks. And in that process, that takes an NADH and turns it back into NAD+. So that's the important part of fermentation. The different kinds of fermentation have different intermediates, but they all do the same thing. They all reoxidize NADH back into NAD+. In our own bodies, it happens by lactic acid fermentation, which is a more direct process. Actually, go back up to alcohol fermentation for just a second. Notice that in this process, because of this decarboxylation, alcohol fermenters not only produce alcohol, they produce CO2, which is exactly why beer not only has alcohol in it, but it's carbonated. The CO2 is a natural occurrence of the fermentation. But the yeast that do that fermentation are not wanting to make alcohol. In fact, if it builds up, it's going to kill them. It's toxic. They're doing it because they have to keep glycolysis working, because they don't have cellular respiration. Okay, but in us, we don't do it the same way. And it's good that we don't, because if we did it the same way, we would produce CO2, which would acidify our blood and kill us. Right? When you hold your breath, it's not because you're out of oxygen, it's because the CO2 builds up in your blood, acidifies it, and the brain detects that small change in pH as an emergency, basically, and it says it forces you to breathe, so that you blow that CO2 off and let it go back to more alkaline rather than more basic. So we don't do that. We take our pyruvate directly from glycolysis and send it through the fermentation process, which accomplishes the same thing. But since we're doing it with pyruvate instead of acetaldehyde, we make a different end product, which is lactic acid or lactate instead. Now, this also can't build up to very high levels or it's going to start messing with us, which is why you can't sprint indefinitely. Now, if you're well fed, or if you carry food with you, you could jog pretty much indefinitely. You might not want to, but you could. Your body's not going to shut down. Because jogging, you're at a slow enough pace that your breathing rate is enough to supply enough oxygen for cellular respiration. But if you're sprinting, you're using ATP even faster than cellular respiration can make it. And you can't deliver an oxygen to the cells fast enough. because you're outpacing the ability of your respiratory system to bring in that much oxygen. So that means the cell's only choice at that point, at this fork in the road, since cellular respiration is shut down when oxygen is not available anymore, is to go to fermentation. And that'll work for a while. It doesn't make nearly as much ATP, by the way, because you only get the two per glucose that fermentation makes. But it keeps working for a while until lactic acid builds up so much that your body's going to shut down for that. So that's part of fatigue, is the buildup of lactic acid by fermentation. Yeah. Yes, the training changes their respiratory system, their heart, everything adjusts to be more efficient. And so they actually have a greater metabolic scope, as it's called, which is the range in your metabolic rate from resting to maximal. In non-exercising people, it's not as big a range. But when you train, it gets much bigger. So they have a lower resting heart rate. And when they're really sprinting, it can go above ours. And therefore, they have a hell of a lot of range, basically. But aerobically, before the fermentation happens, they're also just better trained to deliver more oxygen more efficiently so that you can keep up with the demand and don't have to go into fermentation. So they don't fatigue as much. Yeah.
Isn't that another way to look at it as a backup?
It is a backup. That's why I said a little bit ago that when you get to the fork in the road, you certainly want to take this path because that's a bigger payoff. This is there in case, though, so that you don't die. So, yes, it is a backup. But let's look at the next slide and talk more about this. Here's the fork in the road I was talking about. Glycolysis happens anyway, in either case, whether there's oxygen present or not. If there is oxygen present, though, the cell will certainly take the aerobic respiration route rather than the fermentation route. But what is it that makes the decision? How does the cell know I should go to cellular respiration rather than fermentation? Well, it's simply what oxygen does, right? Oxygen allows for the cellular respiration to happen, and the cellular respiration empties those taxis automatically as part of the process, right? So it's just naturally going to happen if oxygen is available. If oxygen's not available, this whole pathway fills up, basically, and this is just the only thing that can happen. So it automatically switches over when it has to. 23. Now, everything we just talked about is represented by these squares. You have glycolysis here, and then you have the three parts of cellular respiration here. Oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, citric acid cycle, and oxidative phosphorylation. Right? So this is the overall process of this whole chapter, the complete oxidation of glucose. And that is the central pathway for use of fuels. But we've studied it from the viewpoint of glucose as the fuel, which it usually is. Glucose is the master fuel. It's used more often than anything else. But it's not the only fuel. We can use other things as fuel. And this shows you that if we use other things as fuels, they just either directly get fed somewhere into the middle of this overall process, or they get converted into something that can be fed into that process somewhere. So yep, at the top you have the three nutrient classes. Nutrient classes are simply the kinds of molecules that are typically used as food. Proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. Proteins, you already know, are polymers of amino acids, so digestion has to happen first. We don't use proteins as fuel. In fact, we don't use them as fuel very often anyway, but in the cases when we want to use the energy in protein rather than using them as proteins, then we first have to digest them into the amino acids. And as you see here, once you have the amino acids, they can actually feed in at various places depending on what the amino acids are. And once they're in that process, it's just like they came from glucose originally. They're just skipping some steps. And similarly for carbohydrates, so they come in as starch, for instance. That's a polysaccharide. Well, we digest that into the glucose molecules. Glucose goes straight in. That's what we've been studying. But there are other monosaccharides as well, right? Like fructose, for instance. Well, fructose is actually, if you look at the details of glycolysis, it's something that glucose gets transformed into as part of glycolysis. So it can just skip that step and go into a later step of glycolysis. And similarly for other monosaccharides. They either can go directly into glycolysis, or they can be easily transformed into yet another sugar that can go into glycolysis. And for fats, which are the main... I mean, fats are lipids, remember, but lipids that are used for fuel are fats. We use other lipids for other reasons. And remember, they're not polymers, but they still are big molecules, so they need to be digested into their four components, a glycerol and three fatty acids. Well, the glycerol can feed right into the part of glycolysis that makes glyceraldehyde. It's the same root as glycerol. And the fatty acids can actually be processed. Remember, they're a long chain of hydrocarbons. By taking two carbons off at a time, you can make those. Those are effectively acetyl. Or not effectively, they are acetyl. If you take two at a time off, that's acetyl. So you can just deliver those to coenzyme A, and it drives them to the citric acid cycle just like they came from glucose originally. So that's the central pathway, and the other non-glucose fuels feed into it in one place or another depending on where they came from. Yeah.
What is
that? Oh, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because I forgot to. NH3 is ammonia. And I said that proteins we usually recycle more than use for energy. The main fuels are carbohydrates. The main stored fuels are lipids, fats. Proteins can be used as stored energy, but they typically aren't. Instead, because of all the important things that proteins do, they just get dismantled into amino acids and then built into brand new proteins that are different proteins based on the instructions in our genes. So the amino acids get recycled. And that's why you don't really need all that much protein in your diet, because you're not really continuously using it. You need a little bit of replacement, but not all that much. Mostly what you need for energy is carbohydrates and lipids. But anyway, in the cases in which you do use protein as an energy source, you first have to digest it into amino acids to be small enough. But amino acids, remember, are called that because they have an amino group, an NH3 group. And that nitrogen that makes them amino is problematic. So it needs to be removed. Amino acids need to be deaminated so that it contains just the same stuff that all these other fuels do, carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen only, not nitrogen. And when that happens, a byproduct of doing that is ammonia, which isn't allowed to build up too much because it's toxic. So that's a major function. And one of the many things the liver does is to process that ammonia into something that's a little less toxic called urea, which is also toxic if it gets high enough level. But that then gets filtered by the kidneys and is part of urine. That's why it's the UR of urea. It's in urine. So we do that, and the more that happens, the more we're in danger of those urea molecules crystallizing in the bloodstream, which causes gout. And that's why, you know, if a person gets gout, which is painful and bad for other reasons, a physician will say, well, are you eating a hell of a lot of meat? Because meat has a lot of protein in it, way more than you need, because you really don't need it as fuel, like I'm saying. So you start catabolizing all this extra protein and you make so much urea that it actually precipitates out of solution in your blood and crystallizes. That's what gout is. But anyway, yeah, that's why you have this NH3 coming out. You have to get rid of the ammonia. You have to get rid of the nitrogen for it to be usable fuel. And that's another reason why we don't usually use it at amino acids as fuel. We use the ones that are just carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. 24 is the last slide. And the only thing that's different here, you still have this central pathway, but this shows you the control of the pathway. So there are enzymes at each step along the way, but certain enzymes in these pathways are really important control points. We talked about feedback already for controlling pathways. Well, phosphofructokinase is one of these major enzymes that is a control point. And these red arrows represent inhibition, so it's turning things down. The green arrow represents activation, so it's ramping up the process. Right now, we don't continuously run cellular glycolysis and cellular respiration full out. That would be totally wasteful, right? We have to adjust the amount of ATP that we're making and therefore adjust glycolysis and cellular respiration according to what we're doing. How does the cells know how to do that? By feedback. So ATP itself serves as a signal that will inhibit phosphofructokinase and therefore turn down glycolysis. Now that should make sense to you, right? Because you have a pool of ATP-ADP. If that pool becomes almost entirely ATP, that means you've already made enough. You have some to spare, and that extra ATP interferes with the process and turns down production of even more, which would be wasteful. Okay, so ATP inhibits it. Same with citrate. If it builds up, that's a signal to the cell you've made enough. On the other hand, if you have a bunch of AMP, and I mentioned this several lectures ago, AMP you usually don't have very much of. It's usually going back and forth between ATP and ADP. If you're not making enough ATP, though, you use up all your ATP that's available for whatever this strenuous exercise you are doing is, for instance, and then you start using ADP as energy source and dephosphorylate that into AMP. That's like taking using a debit card when you have a very low balance, right? You're in danger of overdrawing. So that the cell recognizes a sudden increase in AMP as an emergency situation. You need to drastically increase the rate of all of this central pathway. That's why it's a green arrow. It stimulates production of more ATP, which solves the problem, as negative feedback always does. No, it doesn't. It's just a good analogy.